Audi.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast, exploring life stories through travel. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Why wait for the icebergs to disappear, dangerously affecting ocean levels, when within them is drinking water that could save people's lives? This is a question retired doctor turned author Paul Stydolf asks in his new novel, Forests in the Sahara. Why aren't governments doing anything about this, or are they? Talking about this, plus Nepal, Hiroshima, Cape Town, Australia, Sri Lanka, Uganda, and much more, it's Paul Stydolf.
The book, Forests in the Sahara, I wrote it, started writing it, because nobody else was doing anything about the fact that ice is disappearing from Antarctica. There are people facing drought, particularly in Africa. This is what particularly focused my attention. And there's no end of information about how the ice is disappearing, but nobody seems to be doing anything about conserving that ice. I've subsequently found out that in 2010, a company did look into ice from Alaska going to India, but felt that it wasn't commercially viable. But other than that, and this was about the time I started writing my book, I just thought, we've got to bring this to attention. I'm educated, but I'm not a scientist, I'm not a geologist, I'm not a specialist in the sort of natural world of Antarctica. So I thought I would write a book. And I was very fortunate that about that time, I met the scientist, chemist, who had worked out how the seeds of Moringa oleifera, which is a tree that which is sort of drought resistant, how these seeds can purify water. And this was the final sort of catalyst, because here was a way of conserving water and a biological means of keeping it pure enough to drink. And so on the basis of that, this book started to take shape.
It's a novel, isn't it? It's a fictional book, even though it's based on something that we hope might become fact and that
people scientists are
around.
Yes, it's very much a fictional book. It's based on fact from a lot of friends who've given me a lot of help and contributed their expertise. But it's also based on my experiences as a young adult. There's nobody you could identify by. You wouldn't know who I had in mind. Nor did I know who I had in mind. These characters emerged out of a sort of mist of my imagination, and I just took as the start of the story the day the warlocks, who are this consortium, take possession of their ship, which they're going to convert into a research ship, to take to Antarctica.
So in the book, am I right in thinking that people do, one of the ideas touted around, or one of the storylines is that people do start using ice from Antarctica to support countries that are going through drought?
The book is about this. Jeffrey is a scientist, he's a biologist, Jeffrey Harvey. He's absolutely focused on this idea from an experience that he had when he was in Africa and encountered this drought. And he got his university friends to join with him to get this research project going. They take a ship to Antarctica to show that it is commercially viable to harvest ice from Antarctica. There's been lots of talk about icebergs being hauled from Antarctica to Africa, to the Middle East. There's actually a company that's doing this, aiming to get a 1 kilometer iceberg to Cape Town. There's another company looking at taking an iceberg to the Gulf. But these are small icebergs compared to what is out there. I'm talking about the ice islands. There's a vast amount of ice that needs to be harvested. And there are caverns throughout the world, and there are depots throughout the world where we can be conserving this. But these islands, they are 10 kilometres, 20 kilometres across. There's one, actually, an ice island has just formed today off Greenland. It's 4 miles across. These are islands of ice, and we're doing nothing to conserve them. And the story is that the ship goes to Antarctica and harvests the ice. Harvesters go onto the ice, they get the ice into lagoons, the tanker takes up the ice as water, and they then set off for Africa.
I know this is something that was mentioned recently with the drought in Cape Town, wasn't it?
That's right.
Could be a possibility of getting a dirty, great
That's
big
right.
iceberg. Well, probably not a dirty, great big iceberg. Probably quite clean and nice, actually.
How dramatic.
And towing it.
How dramatic to see two giant tankers towing a 1 kilometre long iceberg.
Why but haven't they done it already?
Well, there are very few places in the world where you can lodge a 1 kilometre long iceberg anyway. It takes a lot of money, a lot of ingenuity, and it's actually the brainchild of the salvage captain who salvaged the, what's it, Costa Concordia, whatever it was, the Italian ship which capsized. He's got the initiative and he's got the scientific background. He's got a company which he thinks can do this. There are very few people who bring that expertise together. Why hasn't it been done before? Largely finance. People just saying it's not commercially viable. And this is a point that I would raise, that that's the wrong focus. Harvesting ice in the amount that I'm suggesting in this novel is not something for a single company to do. It can't do it. It's something for nation states to do. And I would like to see this subject brought up at international conferences on the environment, just as carbon dioxide levels are brought up, for the world as a whole to be addressing this. And what should be looked at as economically viable is not making a profit, which is what a private company can do, but a sustainable loss should still be an acceptable outcome for harvesting this water, because the water is disappearing. These ice islands, once they've broken free of Antarctica, are disappearing. It's pure water, it's drinkable water that is disappearing, and it's needed.
Not only is it needed, but it's also, if that water goes into the oceans, which it would do, and the sea levels rise, you know, we've all seen those movies and heard about the disastrous effects that might have, and that is also a realistic prospect.
That's right, and you know, we've listened for probably since the sort of 1990s of people talking about how the ocean levels are going to rise and a few more atolls are disappearing, and yet nobody was talking about conserving the water. Nobody was coming up with it. We, the human race, can bring up oil from deep down under the North Sea. Well, that's fantastic technology. Why can we not harvest water that is there on the surface?
Have they got a plan to, has it been looked at? I'm sure it's been looked at, and this might be one of the stumbling blocks, but where do you keep this iceberg? Presumably, once you tow an iceberg from, say, Antarctica to Cape Town, a lot of it is going to disappear on the way, but hopefully it's big enough to not completely disappear on the way. But a lot of it is going to disappear on the way, and then where do you keep that iceberg so it doesn't just melt off the coast of Cape Town?
No, that's right. They've actually are developing a sort of plastic apron, so any water that does melt, they will still hope to keep. It's wonderful. One just hopes they're successful. But it comes back to this place. Who has got the resources? Who has got the wherewithal to place a giant iceberg whilst it's broken down on site? And that is where this whole idea of having tankers to take... You couldn't do it with a 10-kilometre wide iceberg. Nobody, nothing could pull it, and nothing could conserve that ice. Why wait for it to disappear? This is a massive project. What is in a risk is that as countries see the possibility, so they start competing with each other. And that is why we need an international conference to decide how the ice islands and large icebergs are tackled, where the engineering expertise lies, which I think will probably be with oil companies, to whatever you call it, mine or harvest this ice. We need to get on with it.
To start breaking it down into maybe tanker-sized chunks and carrying those across the ocean.
And in the book, the harvesters harvest the ice and fire it into the lagoons.
How close are we to this actually happening, do you think? To that conference taking place, to governments and nations getting together?
I keep lighting matches, Lisa. That's what I'm doing with this book and when I talk. I just keep lighting matches in the hope that people with the greater expertise, with greater contacts, say, yes, of course, why aren't we doing it? And it's all very well to say, oh, this is silly, it's all unimaginary. It's not silly. I look at the droughts are where people are dying who don't need to be dying because of lack of drinking water. I also look at monsoon areas. I worked in a mission hospital in Nepal, and I saw the damage that happens from the monsoons. And one of the first things you notice is that they don't have any drinking water. So countries that you might think are flooded with water, actually they need drinking water. And you can keep this water in caverns, you can keep it in depots. And there are countries which store fuel oil in caverns, you know, and mines for emergencies. We can do the same with water.
Tell me about your time in Nepal.
It was a time in my early adulthood. I was very restless. I didn't know quite which direction I was going myself. I had become devout religiously. I had felt a very deep commitment to medicine, and I had the opportunity to go and work in a mission hospital in Tan Sen in western Nepal. It was during the monsoons. All the roads were wiped out, so I was facing a trek across Nepal even just to get to the hospital. And once I was in the hospital, it was a fantastic experience because it's the United Mission to Nepal. The Nepalese had allowed the mission hospital in on the understanding that it was a United Mission. And I met some fantastic people there from all around the world. There was a Japanese doctor there who'd been the... Well, he wasn't a doctor, but he was a Japanese minister. He had been the closest survivor of the center of Hiroshima. When the atom bomb went off, he was at the bottom of an empty ammo depot. He had come out 2 weeks later. He was the only survivor that close. I went with him on walking tours, health trips of the vicinity. There was the only way was to go on walking tours. Walking where there are landslides have wiped out not only the roads but villages. It was very exciting. It was a sort of medicine that I couldn't have seen any other time. This was looking back to the 1970s. Maybe things have changed. I was a medical student. Yeah, it was very instructive. These people, even the X-ray machine had to come up on the back of porters to the hospital. Everything had been brought up on the back of porters. It was a form of, it was an enlightenment for me. I met some great people. And yes, I think that experience worked its way into the novel.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, that countries that have a lot of rain also have a lack of pure water?
Well, the situation is once the monsoons come, it is unbelievable to somebody in this country who hasn't experienced it. And there aren't pipes of water. I'm actually in the hospital. Every night I was given a bucket of water, and that water was to wash in and flush my loo. That was all I had, and I had a small can of drinking water. Water is very precious. In many parts of the world, water is very precious. The pipes can easily get destroyed. The sources can become contaminated. That is why fresh water is needed, and it's needed quickly.
Your work and the book and your research has also been inspired by trips to Africa.
Yes, As I said, as a young adult, I was very unsettled the direction I was going. I had a fascination in game conservation and actually in wildlife conservation, not just game conservation. And I went and worked with an animal ecology unit in a game park in Uganda, in the Queen Elizabeth Park. And I had 3 months there doing mainly elephant studies, also Egyptian geese, also warthog. And at the end of it, I had had a fantastic experience where I came back knowing I wanted to work with people and that my interest in game conservation or wildlife conservation was an interest. It wasn't the way I wanted my life to go.
What was Uganda like in the 70s, was it?
Yes, well, end of 60s. It was still at the time of President Obote. It was still at the end, there was still the tail end of expats who were living there, people who actually, not just expats, people who had lived their lives there. When I say, you know, people from Europe.
Colonial types,
the civil service and so on. It was, I wasn't actually in the sort of the centres of Uganda. I was very quickly out to the game park, but I simply lived in the game park. There, we had game rangers who really knew their work. We had the scientists who really knew their side of things. And I had a background. I have many friends and relatives. My father's South African, and I have many friends and relatives who from Africa. So I had a deep feeling for Africa, and I thought that at that stage I was going out. My career was going to be in game conservation, but I came back changed, but hugely more knowledgeable.
How did it change you? And how do you think travel changes you?
I think that journey changed me because it was an experience. It was outside ordinary travel. I was actually working amongst the game, and really it was a wonderful experience in that, and I was meeting some really top-rate people in their field. How travel has changed me, and I think it's meeting the people that you meet, because wherever you go, you're maybe there for not very long, but you meet the people who live there, people who've worked there, made success of their lives there, and it's having the contact with those people and their experience, and being able to leapfrog all that they've had to learn and to gain in a very short time a lot of information and a lot of understanding. I think we tend to live amongst our own sort of cultural groups, and just by being prepared to live in a different cultural group is very, very enlightening.
So did you continue to travel and be something of an explorer?
No, I thought I was going to. I didn't. I then medical career, and I thought, well, yes, once you're a doctor, you can travel a lot, and maybe some people did. But I found that medicine was a bit more serious than I'd realised as a student.
I think everyone thinks as a student that finds out that life is a bit more serious than you anticipated.
You've got to go where opportunity takes you. And opportunity
need to earn a living and all
That's
sorts.
Right.
You can't just bum around.
I went on a round the world trip. After I had finished my medical training, my basic training, just before I started in general practice, I went round the world, literally taking 3 months to visit friends who had very conveniently positioned themselves around the world. And that in itself was, a great experience.
So where else have you been?
Australia, United States, several places. My friends, again, conveniently situated themselves on the eastern seaboard and the western seaboard. Canada, Australia from Perth to Melbourne, Sydney, and then, and of course, Europe. Lots in Europe.
What's been your favourite experience in those times?
Of all my travelling, working in the mission hospital in Nepal. Because at that time, as I say, I was very devout, and I was living amongst a community who devoted themselves to a very harsh environment, and yet they were making a great success of it. And you didn't feel the harshness; you felt as if this was as normal a life as anybody else. It was a life without great luxuries, it was a life without great wealth, and yet there was a huge amount to enjoy.
When you've been to America, what stood out most for you in the States, or what experience?
Frankly, the best trip I ever had to the States was actually with my family. And we arrived in Florida just as Hurricane Wilma was arriving. And we stayed in our hotel and we said to the local restaurant staff, look, are you leaving? And they said no. And so we decided, well, look, if they decided that it's dangerous enough, they're going to leave, we'll decide. And that night, Hurricane Wilma struck, but it struck 20 miles below us. So we had all the excitement of the hurricane and none of the danger. And it was such a memorable experience. Going out that following morning at 5 o'clock in the morning onto the beach and just seeing the clouds swirling above you, feeling that blast of wind, but knowing that no storm surge was about to take you away. That was exciting. That was lovely.
What did it look like? Could you actually see the hurricane?
Yeah, you see, we saw the grey swirling clouds, and Hollywood sort of produces it in these sort of disaster movies.
And you see it on the satellite images, don't you?
Yes.
I can visualise it now, sort of somewhere over Florida, you've got this big circle
of
cloud.
And you can see this circle of cloud, and the people 20 miles below where the hurricane hit were having a bad time of it. But we were having this fantastic time. And it was very exciting.
What other memorable trips can I ask you about?
Frankly, Europe. I have loved my travels in Europe. Just heading off as a student, not knowing where I was going, just getting on a plane, arriving in Greece and making my way. Very exciting. Wonderful people
very,
to meet.
We're very lucky here in the UK that we have such proximity to Europe, which is a cluster of many countries that are vastly different when you cross the border from one into
Absolutely.
The other, and not just the language, but the culture and the food and, you know, at one time the currency. I think we're very lucky here, and we don't necessarily appreciate it when visitors come over from, say, Australia or the States and they realise that within an hour, you know, you can be from one European capital to another on the right train.
One thing comes to mind as I talk to you, and that is when I went to Australia, the Australians I met were a great bunch, but Australians seem to have a different dimension to life. And I arrived in Perth, and I was staying with this surgeon, heck of a nice guy, he's a man in his 50s. We got talking sport, and the guy said, well, you know, what sort of sports do you like? I said, well, I like swimming, I like kayaking. And he said, oh, this is great, he said, yeah, it'll be great. So he took me swimming in the ocean, and I had never experienced waves such as hit me on the ocean, and they said, yeah, Paul, I've arranged kayaking this weekend. And I said, oh, that's great. And he said, well, I'm taking you on, I think it was the Margaret River. I said, okay. So we set off with our kayaks. And as we got close to where we were going to launch our kayaks, we saw another couple just down by the river. And the guy said to the surgeon I was with, he said, can we launch from here? And the surgeon said, yes, but have you got your crash helmets with you? And the guy said, yes, we got crash helmets. Have you? And I said, no, we haven't got crash helmets. And the surgeon turned to me and said, yeah, of course we got crash helmets. And I thought, what have I let myself in for? Because my idea of kayaking was kayaking on the River Thames, or, you know, kayaking just a little bit off the coast. And he took me down this white water. Uh-huh. And this to him was normal kayaking. And I found this everything about, I survived somehow. I found myself clinging to a rock with a 12-foot drop beneath me, a waterfall, just thinking, I'm not going over that waterfall. I was facing backwards at the time. And I crawled onto this rock, my kayak disappeared and was found about 400 yards down the river. Well, I survived. And he said, Paul, I'm sorry, I didn't realize, I thought you had kayaking experience. I said, yes, I did. I kayaked down the Moselle in Germany. You know, I kayaked on the River Thames. I've never done this sort of kayaking. But I found that this is the Australian way. They are so athletic. They live such outdoor lives that, yeah, that was an eye-opener to me. That was part of an experience.
Have you ever read Bill Bryson's book about Australia? I forget the title of it now, but the opening chapter is about everything that can kill you in Australia. But, you know, you've got your funnel web spiders, you've got crocodiles in the rivers, the lakes and the sea.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, all sorts of hazards, you know,
you've got
people
the cone
falling
fish.
There.
Yes, and
yes,
that's right.
the jellyfish and great white sharks and everything like that. And it's just the brilliant opening chapter, because it's like, these are all the things about Australia. Yeah. That put you off going. But it is this magical, fabulous place. And they've got so much space, haven't they? They've got bigger houses and gardens and streets. Have you ever been anywhere that's challenged you or where you felt afraid?
Oh, yes. Coming back to Nepal. But in crossing those, we were literally crossing landslides, which had wiped out, say, villages and so on. I found myself on one occasion, the road... had disappeared, and there was just this precipitous drop, and the Japanese missionary I was with said, well, we've got to get across, you know, this is our only way. So he went first, and we were just clinging on to mud, this mud wall. There was about a 30-foot drop below us on into a river. I got about halfway across, and my rucksack snagged on a bit of branch. I realized at that moment that nobody could help me. And all my life, I'd always, you know, there'd always been safety ropes or something. And this was the first time there wasn't. And it was up to me, and I managed to free myself and to get across. And after that, I had lost my fear. And at the end of the, when time came to return to Kathmandu, we came to a place where the bus could no longer cross. There was this sort of 400-foot sheer mudslide, and the mud stretched probably another 400-foot down into the river, a torrential river, and all the bus occupants had to run across this mudslide with stones still falling. And we went in groups of three. Now, I don't think at the start of that tour I would have ever been able to do it, you know, when I first hit Nepal. As it was, we went across and we were laughing all the way. And yet one false step and we would have been in the river 400 foot below us. It changes your perspective of life. I learned a lot then. That took away a lot of unnatural fear.
Yeah. There's people in many countries that I've been to that seem to have, I don't think life is cheaper, of course, because they care just as much about each other, but they seem to definitely have less health and safety concerns than we do certainly here in the UK.
I think even in Europe, yes, the plenty of places in Greece and Italy where you feel a freedom. Let's say you feel a freedom if you go out in a boat or you go abseiling. You feel a sense of freedom, yes.
And you just got back from Spain, actually. Talking of a sense of freedom,
yes.
Spain's one of the most wonderful countries in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
Well, tell me about your experience in Spain.
Oh, lovely little fishing harbour, but my wife and I enjoy going to different places. So we went to, I pronounce it Jerez.
Jerez.
Thank you, Jerez. I knew I'd get it wrong. But the wine, the sherry growing area.
It's a lovely place.
That was our place this time. Last time it was Seville, which was very hot. Very different places. And Jerez, we loved. It was quieter, but the streets were elegant. There were lovely small little streets. The wine growing area, we could look all the way to Cadiz.
Cadiz,
thank you. But I am British. I'm going to say Cadiz.
Right.
No, you're quite right. And it was just this lovely, wonderful scenery. But what we did in Jerez, we were sitting one night, we went to a tapas bar, Was it a tapas bar? I don't
know. No, it's just an outdoor area. It is a tapas bar. And also, I'm just being annoying because,
don't worry.
You know, you don't say you're going to Paris for the weekend, do you? Or Barcelona, you know.
but this, we were sitting there and we'd ordered what we thought was our tapas, and two dishes came which we didn't realise what we'd ordered. It didn't matter. It was all part of the fun of it. It wasn't a place on the tourism map, and that was great. But we noticed that all the people around us were eating, they had glass tumblers full of tiny snails.
Oh, yes.
And we've never seen this anywhere else in France, in Spain. And we didn't think that, we thought it was just a delicacy of the cafe. But as we walked through Jerez, we saw other cafes where this was a delicacy. You know about it, obviously.
Well, I do. And I know about this because my five-year-old ate them last time we were there a few weeks ago. And it's not, I mean, I don't eat meat, so I do eat seafood. I'm a pescatarian, so that's a whole other thing because everyone draws the line somewhere and, you know, most of us cannot really say why. But I wouldn't eat a snail. And my five-year-old eats absolutely everything. And he said he's always wanted to try snails. I was like, oh, God, yeah, okay, well, if you really want to. And we ordered the snails. And, you know, I've seen people eat l'escargot in France and even the UK and wherever. And it's all like these delicate little snails in a nice sauce and everything. This is just a cup of snails. You know, it looks like you could have picked them up from the garden.
They look like pistachio nuts.
Yeah, they do. They're smaller. Yeah. They're smaller and whiter than, say, garden snails. But it does look like, you know, you could have picked them up from somewhere. And I think they probably just have picked them up from somewhere. And I thought it was completely gross. But the five-year-old, he ate 10 and then decided he didn't really like them and wasn't going to have them again. But he ate 10 snails, you know.
And then passed the rest to mummy.
Yeah, exactly. I was, oh, God, just the thought of it. Well, that's wonderful. And have you got any more trips planned then?
So we went to Sri Lanka last year. And my wife and I were celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary. And we thought rather than give each other presents, we would take the whole family on this trip. It was lovely. The Sri Lankans were lovely people. We again went in what was supposed to be a time of cyclones, but we didn't have any. We only had rain on our last day. And we went into the tea growing area, and I could have stayed there for the rest of my life. It was wonderful. It was lovely. But as well as that, we went down to the coast, to a place called Welegama in Gaul, which is where, unfortunately, the tsunami had hit. So it had been a place of tragedy, but you wouldn't know it now. The place and the people were really lovely, and it was thriving. And we went also inland to Surinaga, the Lion Rock, which has an old palace at the top of it, which was only sort of discovered again about 150 years ago. The food was lovely. The Sri Lankans have a curry that's so hot none of us could touch it, but they were very considerate about making it eatable for us. It was a wonderful experience, yeah. The only thing I would say is that if you're worried about driving, you don't think of driving in Sri Lanka. They have their own way of driving. You have a narrow two-lane road, and you have a big bus coming one way, a big bus coming the other, overtaking a tuk-tuk, which is overtaking a scooter, which is overtaking a bicycle, and somehow they all get round. And it worries you for the first 20 minutes, and after that you forget about it. But you just don't look.
It's terrifying, absolutely terrifying. You've driving been there then, anything like that, absolutely. Yeah. Driving anywhere like that is, you know, I'd never do it. I'd leave it to the terrifying taxi and tuk-tuk drivers that have taken me around. So my last question is always about music, because I think that music and travel often go hand in hand. You have more time to listen to music, and music can evoke wonderful memories. And if you had to choose one song that reminded you of a time or a place of travel, what would that song be?
Well, the song that I would choose would be the song which reminds me of my honeymoon, which is True Love by Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly. In the Seychelles, we were on this schooner. It was midnight. It was supposed to be a midnight party, but the band had got so drunk itself that they were fast asleep. And so you had these sort of groups of possibly half a dozen couples, mostly honeymooners, I guess, on this schooner. We were on a schooner on the Indian Ocean. The moon was shining. So in the bows of the boat, I sang to my wife this song. And when I finished, the other honeymooners were all listening quietly. It's the only time I've ever dared sing in public, but it's a treasured memory.
Thank you so much for that, Paul, and I do hope that sometime soon we see nations starting to talk more about how we can harvest the ice and get water to regions that most need it. Thank you very much for listening. Join us for a new guest every Tuesday.